not afraid to speak up today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. President Trump's new pick for National Security Advisor is getting good reviews. Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster is known for speaking his mind.
The president has chosen a man who is absolutely unafraid to go toe-to-toe with anybody, including the president of the United States.
Also, we meet a Syrian man in Jordan who's asking the U.S. for asylum. He's waited 3 years for an answer.
I told the interviewer, please tell me no or yes.
Plus, a visit to one of the newest museums in Paris, home to some of the oldest voice recordings around. We'll take a listen. Those stories and much more ahead on The World. Glad you could join us. Lots to cover today. The new EPA chief meets with his staff. Morocco bets big on solar power. And we'll pay a visit to a museum of sound recording in Paris. But first, a look at the new National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. Donald Trump picked him yesterday to fill the post left vacant by Mike Flynn, who was forced to resign. McMaster has gotten a lot of praise, but it's a difficult job for anyone. Former Army Colonel John Nagle has known and worked closely with McMaster as a fellow soldier and scholar for more than 20 years. I asked him what McMaster is like as a person.
HR is the most bullheaded, nicest, smartest, most ego-free person I think I've ever met. I was with him on Friday afternoon for a previously scheduled event here in Philadelphia. He gave a talk at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here on the Army's modernization plans. He is absolutely dedicated to taking care of America's national interests around the globe, an absolutely committed public servant, razor sharp, and actually every once in a while, even a little bit funny.
And what is he like as a military officer?
He is the most demanding trainer of men, the best implementer of both tactics and strategy, and the best military leader, I think, of his generation.
Lots of superlatives. He's also a bit of a maverick.
Yeah, it's super irritating. I really want to be able to tell you something bad about him. I keep coming back to George Packer's line that he's getting a little bit thick around the middle, a line I used on him again on Friday. That's all the dirt you're going to get on this guy. The Army hasn't loved him. He's been very critical of some of the Army's thinking and the Defense Department's thinking about the nature of future war. He is a guy who will do what he believes is right to the detriment of his own career, never, never to the detriment of his troops.
Doesn't sound like he would have trouble speaking truth to President Trump.
I think that that's the really remarkable thing about this appointment. The president has chosen a man who is absolutely unafraid to go toe-to-toe with anybody, including the president of the United States, say what he believes, fight absolutely tooth and nail for what he believes is right. Ultimately, at the end, he is a serving lieutenant general. He will salute the commander-in-chief, literally, and will execute the orders to the utmost of his abilities. But I tell you, I think the president is going to have a hard time convincing HR that he's wrong.
How do you think he'll handle managing a sort of complicated committee-like structure? You know, you mentioned his bullheadedness.
The good news here is that he's got a very good relationship with Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, with John Kelly, the Secretary of Homeland Security. He will be respectful of the cabinet secretaries. He understands how executive agencies work, and he will make the trains run on time. He's not ideological. He understands, for instance, that while we are facing a significant threat in radical Islamic extremism, the Islamic world is not our enemy.
John, he's going to have to go up against the president's chief strategist, though, Steve Bannon. I mean, you say he's not ideological, but Steve Bannon clearly is.
I'd buy tickets to watch that fight.
And you, any insight you can give us about how McMaster will approach it?
HR will be extremely respectful and will be completely committed to his positions. He will attempt to use logic. He will rely upon history. He will rely upon his combat experience. And ultimately, I think one of the advantages HR has, so Steve Bannon has the president's trust. If it were not for Bannon, I don't think President Trump would have been elected. But HR has literal combat experience into wars, and we know the president has an awful lot of regard for that experience.
I know he's your friend, so you're not really the right person to ask this, but what do you think this appointment does to the credibility of the administration?
The administration badly needed a credible appointment. They needed someone who was seen as a professional, as a capable professional, who across the board in the national security community would be seen as wow.
Former U.S. Army Colonel John Nagel has known and worked with H.R. McMaster for more than a decade. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump has said he'll announce a new executive order this week on refugees and immigrants. That's to replace his travel ban that's been blocked by the courts. A lot of people are eager to see the details of the new order, especially refugees who've been waiting years to get word on their applications to come to the U.S. The world's Shireen Jafari met with one Syrian couple in Jordan.
Thayer Al-Tahli is a familiar face here. He's a television news anchor. He's also a Syrian living in exile. The 29-year-old supported the uprising against Bashar al-Assad. Thayer was an activist. He organized demonstrations and set up a student union at his university in Homs. That didn't please the Syrian regime.
I arrested about three times, one of them about 1 month and the other 4 days, and the last time it was 2 months.
Thayer considers himself lucky. He wasn't tortured or moved around from jail to jail. He thinks it's because he was a student and educated.
Were you scared?
No, I think no. I expected that I will arrest someday. When we went in demonstrations, we expected to shoot in our head, shoot in our neck.
But the last time he got out of jail, that was it for him. He had had enough. He fled Syria and came to Jordan. But even here, he doesn't feel safe. He receives death threats from the Syrian regime and also from ISIS. So it makes sense that Thayer wants to get as far away as possible from Syria. He and his wife applied to the UN Refugee Agency to be resettled in the U.S. That was 3 years ago. He's been interviewed over and over again. Some of the questions just baffle him.
They wanted to know what the names of my teachers when I was a child. When I was at the first class and second class, they wanted to know that. They wanted to know why I participate in the revolution. I told them that I was one of the repeals against the regime. So it's okay. I am an activist man in Syria. And because of that, I want to go to America. I am not normal man.
By not normal, he means that he's in danger. But then there were more questions.
Did you hijack plane before in your life? I said yes. Of course not. Of course I didn't do that. And they asked me, did you ever help someone to go to America? I told them that no. Of course I didn't know anyone and I didn't help anyone to go to America.
Because Thayer had applied to be resettled in the U.S., he could not seek asylum in a different country. He had to wait for a final decision before he could appeal to, say, Canadians or the Australians or any other country. He felt stuck.
I told the interviewer, please tell me no or yes.
Thayer says the whole process made him feel as if he's a criminal, not a refugee. Then, one day, finally, he got an answer, not the one he wanted. His file was going to be placed on hold.
3 years and you are America. 3 years and you want more information?
It's important to remember here, this happened before Donald Trump took office, before the temporary ban on Syrian refugees. There is room for everyone on earth, reads a sign in the lobby of the UN Refugee Agency office in Amman. The building used to be an old school. Today is the place where the world's biggest refugee crisis is being handled. Maryam Bala is one of the people in charge of the resettlement program.
Jordan became
the largest resettlement operation specifically for Syrian refugees in the world in 2016. We didn't know it would take on such a big number, so it really grew in an unexpected manner.
Bala says every host country has its own vetting and screening process. But in general, they give priority to the most vulnerable cases. That means refugees with major health problems or the ones who have witnessed trauma, for example. How does the U.S. compare to other countries? I asked Bala.
We know that they have a vetting process, and we know that it's one of the most scrutinized processes of any person entering the U.S. It involves a number of federal agencies that are being solicited and that are involved in this process.
As difficult and lengthy as all this is today, Bala says it used to be much worse.
When I was doing resettlement in the 90s, because that's when it started with the Somalis, refugees didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have mobile phones. We were hardly working with computers. We were still working with typewriters. Refugees came to us physically when they had questions. They were writing letters. We were writing letters back to them. Now we have email, we have Facebook, we have social media, we have mobile phones. People are connected. This is a very, very, very big difference.
Bala's organization is keeping a close eye on President Trump's temporary ban on Syrian refugees. She says the families who were scheduled to fly to the U.S. have been able to do so, but the cases that were mid-process remain on hold. Tahir Al-Tahli says he's had enough. His wife is 7 months pregnant. The couple say they just want to move on.
I give up to go to America. The next step I will do, that I will close my file.
Closing his application will allow Thayer to apply to other countries. France, Canada, and Australia are on his list.
I will go to any country except America. I will not go to America.
3 years of answering questions and sitting in interviews, and now he'll have to start all over again. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Amman, Jordan.
For those refugees who do make it to safety in the U.S. or Europe, it's not always what they expected. There's a lot of disillusionment, enough disillusionment to make a small number of refugees actually turn around and go home. Rani Khaled Yaqub is a 26-year-old Christian woman from a town near Mosul in northern Iraq. She escaped ISIS and sought asylum in France with her 2 young sons. Her husband was killed during their escape. But after 2 years in the French city of Marseille, Yaqub decided to go back to Iraq. Her friends thought she was crazy, she says, but she felt isolated in France. She says, here in Iraq, we socialize. If you don't have family, you have your neighbors, your friends. In Marseille, you feel alone. You don't interact with people. That's what it's like there. As a Christian, Yaqub is part of a persecuted minority in Iraq, but in Marseille, she felt almost invisible. She says, yes, there were Arabs there from Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria, but she felt different from them. And she says the French people she met were a little cold. Now Yaqub lives in Erbil with her 2 sons. She says they can have a better life there. You can read more of Yaqub's story at PRI.org. You're listening to The World. 5 more days to go before the Oscars, and we've been dipping into the nominations for the best foreign language films. Today we hear from Martin Sandfleet, the Danish director of Land of Mine. This is not really a war film. It's more of a post-war film, and in the process it becomes an anti-war film. My colleague, Marco Werman, spoke with Sandfleet about Land of Mine.
Well, it's about a sergeant or a nation who forces young German prisoners out into the beaches to disarm mines.
Right. It's the end of World War II. There are all these German mines that have been placed on the Danish beaches, and these boys were conscripted to demine the beaches. So give us some details about this period of history, the real history of this whole episode that you found compelling enough to make a film about it.
Well, basically, I thought, you know, for myself, I needed our nation to show a more, I don't know if I would call it a true face, but they have a tendency, all nations have, but Denmark also in particularly has a tendency of showing themselves from the good side. And I knew there were a lot of hidden stories lying around. So I've always been interested in Second World War, and I started researching about some dark chapters of our nation, and I found this. First, it was about us breaking the Geneva Convention, but then I found out that we used very young boys, and I thought that might be good enough to write that into a movie somehow.
Yeah, so what is the story? Who were these German boys, and how did they end up, after World War II, prisoners of war in Denmark?
Well, they were in camps, German camps, just beneath the border, and it was the Brits who gave the Danes an order to use the Germans, and of course the Danes didn't mind. And nobody was liking the Germans, and it was a great time to get payback, so to speak.
How many boys actually died in these demining operations? Were you able to find out in your research?
Well, around 500 or 400 died, and around 900 to 1,000 got blown up, lost arms or legs.
So in the movie, tell me a bit about the Danish officer who is in charge of these boys, Sergeant Rasmussen. At first, he seems like the antagonist in the film, but fairly quickly we see he may be the boys' best hope for surviving this insane demining operation.
Yeah. Carl represents, you know, all the sergeants that was on the beach. He's like a fiction character who is the very worst of what the humans can be and evolves into what I believe we should have done. And he's actually looking forward to get his payback. He can't wait for the Germans to come. So when he sees that he gets a bunch of boys up there, he's fairly disappointed because what to do with his hate?
Findest du eigentlich komisch bin? Amüsiere ich dich? Lächelst du, Soldat?
Nein, der fällt mir immer.
Guck mich an!
But slowly he begins to see that these boys, they're not responsible and they're just boys. And the more time he spends with them, the more he tends to see that they're not that different from him after all.
I imagine he must embody a lot of what Denmark felt right after the war, kind of. One, we have to get rid of these mines and get our country back to normal. But two, still a lot of hatred for Germany right after the war. What did that period after World War II kind of do psychically to Denmark?
We weren't different than anybody else. It was allowed to hate the Germans, just the fact that they were Germans. And our country had been occupied for 5 years, so it was allowed. And I think we felt and want to get back at them. Denmark and Germany have always had a strange relationship because we're neighbors. Mm. And in the beginning, I think, you know, Churchill always called Denmark Hitler's little canary bird because in the beginning, we weren't really fighting so much against the Germans. I think we're a very tactical country in that matter.
How well known is this chapter of history for Danes today? Like, did your movie come as a surprise to the public there?
Well, it is an untold story in Denmark, and there wasn't a lot of books written about it. There are small chapters here and there. Yeah, it's an untold story. Nobody really knew about it.
Has it prompted kind of difficult discussions? Any shame?
I'm not sure really why they didn't. Like I said, it's not one of our finest moments, and every nation has a tendency of portraying themselves as the good nation, and Denmark is no different. There is a lot of dark chapters of our nation, and why the historians didn't choose to write books about this, I don't know. I did receive my so to speak, first hate mails calling me not being patriotic enough, but that's really not what it's about. It's about how we people should, you know, treat each other, see each other as individuals instead of hating and judging in general, because, you know, when a world is built up on hate and fear, the eye for an eye mentality doesn't help anybody.
Well, your movie does a great job of reminding us. Are there still mines on the beaches of Denmark today? Were all the mines defused?
Well, they say they cleared most of them, but the day before we started shooting, we actually found a mine, which made the whole
incredible
shooting a little bit more tense, so to speak.
How did you deal with that?
Well, the military came and took it away and made sure that it wouldn't explode, but they... Like they also said, if you find anything, just call us and we'll pick it up.
Danish director Martin Sandfleet, his film Land of Mine is one of the nominees for Best Foreign Language Film this year for the Academy Awards. Martin, thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're We're going to take a breather now and hear from a musician who wants us to focus on peace and respect, two things the world could use a little more of right now. He's singer-songwriter Carlos G. Lopez, originally from the island nation of Cape Verde.
My music, it's between traditional music from Cabo Verde with influence soul music and jazz. I live in France, who are many Cape Verdean community, but for me, I'm good in all around in the world who are peace, no? For me, the most important is peace, respect, and the share good moments with people. In my album, there are 10 songs, but when I sing, there are one song people tell me about this all the time. It's a song called Mamai. Mamai, it's a grandmother. It's a song I wrote for my grandmother. His name is Rosa.
That's Cape Verdean singer-songwriter Carlos G. Lopez telling us about his music and this song, Mamai. You're with the world. I'm Jeb Sharp. Bulgaria's national radio had to stop playing music because of a legal problem, so local artists started giving their music to the station for free.
So we rediscovered amazing, amazing Bulgarian pop and rock and all kinds of new music bands.
That story ahead on the world. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're with The World. It's a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Imagine going to your first official day on the job knowing that some of your new employees lobbied Congress to block you from getting hired. That's basically what happened to Scott Pruitt today. The new chief of the Environmental Protection Agency publicly addressed his staff at the D.C. headquarters today. You could call it an attempt to hit a reset button. The World's Carolyn Beeler was monitoring the talk. Carolyn, what was the tone of this address to the staff?
This was Pruitt really asking his staff to play nice. He talked a little bit about baseball. He name-dropped some of the founding fathers. And he said, listen, you don't know me very well. You might have read about me in the newspaper, but give me a chance, get to know me, and let's all try to get along here.
Stability is something that I believe in very much. You know, we ought to be able to get together and wrestle through some very difficult issues and do so in a civil manner.
So Pruitt was appointed by a president who says he really wants to cut back the EPA. While he was Attorney General of Oklahoma, he sued the EPA more than a dozen times, and there was really unprecedented pushback against his nomination from both former and current EPA employees. So he was really sort of trying to extend an olive branch here and say, hey, give me a chance.
So here he is finally. Was there any substantial environmental policy introduced?
Not really. This was more about broadly setting out his vision for the direction of the agency, which had a lot to do with shifting regulatory authority back to the states. He talked a lot about federalism and not overstepping the authority that Congress has given to the Environmental Protection Agency. He also stressed something that he said more than once during his congressional nomination hearings, which is that being pro-business and pro-environment are not mutually exclusive. He also said one other thing that I think was sort of the closest to his outlining of a mission statement for the Pruitt Environmental Protection Agency, and here is what that was.
Regulations ought to make things regular. Regulators exist to give certainty to those that they regulate. Those that we regulate ought to know what's expected of them so that they can plan and allocate resources to comply. That's really the job of a regulator.
So now that Pruitt is in office, what should we expect to happen?
Well, he's expected to very quickly jump on rolling back the Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama-era regulation that requires electric power generators to cut back on their carbon pollution by about 30%. He alluded to sort of regulatory overstepping leading to litigation in his speech today, and that was probably an allusion to the Clean Power Plan, which is stuck up in the courts right now. And he plans not to just undo the Clean Power Plan, but also bring up the question of whether the EPA even has the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon dioxide. So that's expected to happen very quickly, as is reversal of a rule that extends more federal authority over water protections.
It's so interesting to hear all this and think, okay, this is the United States, this is a federal agency, here he is, and we're talking constantly about a new administration, but the environment is global. Where does this fit into the global picture?
That's right, Jeb. Obviously, pollution does not know borders or boundaries. The U.S. is the world's second largest producer of greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change. And if the head of the agency in charge of protecting the environment in the U.S. is saying, I don't even know if I have authority to regulate carbon dioxide pollution, that really has the power to deflate the international momentum that we have right now to try to fight against climate change.
The story's not over. The world's Carolyn Beeler. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeb.
So there's fear that the U.S. is going to backslide on climate policy under President Trump. One casualty could be investments in renewable energy. But other countries are still forging ahead, investing in solar, wind, and hydro. And in terms of solar, few are doing so as aggressively as Morocco. This year, the country flipped the switch on the first phase of the world's largest concentrated solar power plant. The future is bright for solar power in sun-soaked Morocco, but it's no sure bet. From our partners at the Ground Truth Project, Chris Bentley reports.
When you've driven 4 hours from Marrakesh on windy roads through Morocco's Atlas Mountains to a barren plateau on the edge of the Sahara Desert, it's a little surreal to suddenly find yourself rising off the ground in a new elevator to the top of a sleek observation tower. Step outside, and you're suddenly looking at something even more surreal. 500,000 gleaming mirrors stretching out in every direction across the dusty red earth. This part of Morocco, near the desert outpost of Ouarzazate, is one of the sunniest places on the planet. And this sprawling new solar power plant is the heart of Morocco's big push for clean power and energy independence.
So the mirrors follow the movement of the sun.
Youssef Stitu is a senior project engineer.
At the beginning of the day, they are oriented towards the east, and they are continuing to move, following the sun, until to be oriented to the west side.
All that sunlight can help generate a lot of electricity, but not in the way you might think. It happens here, in the plant's turbine room. You see, those aren't photovoltaic panels surrounding the tower. The mirrors are curved like satellite dishes, and they focus the sunlight onto long rows of metal pipes filled with liquid salt that can reach more than 700 degrees. All that heat is used to make steam and spin turbines, just like a regular power plant. And here's the thing. Stitu says that hot liquid can effectively store some of the sun's energy for up to 3 hours after sundown.
After the sunset, the hot salt is giving back the thermal energy that it goes to produce steam during the night.
And the process addresses a common criticism of solar energy, that it's useless when the sun doesn't shine. This kind of plant is called concentrated solar power, or CSP. It's not a new idea, but it's starting to get a lot more traction. And it's potentially transformational for countries like Morocco that have huge renewable energy resources. But it's also expensive. Just the first phase of this three-part project costs nearly $1 billion, and it could be a risky investment.
It's really impressive, the pace, how they do it. Whether they bet on the right technology, they will find out in the years to come.
Christian Breyer is a renewable energy expert from Finland who has studied the project. Morocco is pumping up its solar capacity faster than just about any other country, but Breyer says it still might not be fast enough to keep up with the speed of innovation in the industry. For instance, plain old photovoltaic panels and batteries to store their output have improved so quickly that they threaten to outshine concentrated solar plants like this one.
We will see a race of these two technologies. But in the very end is really the question how to get the technology cost competitive, and for that they have to grow very fast.
Morocco is moving very fast. When construction here is finished next year, it could be the biggest solar plant in the world. Morocco is hoping its huge investments will help bring prices for concentrated solar technology down. But the country is running another kind of energy race too. 20 years ago, only about half of Moroccans had electricity. Now almost everybody does. And the country's population and economy are growing fast.
Everyone starts to have its own smartphone, PC, laptop, TV.
Samir Rashidi is a project manager at the Moroccan Agency for Solar Energy. I met him in a huge conference center at the recent International Climate Summit in Marrakesh. Rashidi says if Morocco doesn't aggressively develop renewable energy,
then our economic growth will be hostage of foreign fossil fuel.
Those imported fossil fuels are still Morocco's biggest energy source. But King Mohammed VI has declared that by 2030, more than half of the country's energy should come from renewables. The king also promised to tamp down demand by making the country 20% more energy efficient. The country's hoping this new solar plant will help it meet its goals. It's also hoping the project will help kickstart a domestic renewable energy industry that could one day be able to sell cheap renewable electricity to its neighbors. But royal decrees will only get you so far. Morocco's renewable energy revolution will ultimately have to survive on market economics. And Rashidi says so far, the numbers don't always add up.
Actually, now we are importing like 16% of our needs from Spain because they have overcapacity, and sometimes it's really much cheaper to get electricity from Spain than to produce in Morocco. So we are really doing this at a competitive basis.
That kind of competition will help determine whether Morocco's big bet on concentrated solar power will pay off. Rashidi and others here hope that by 2030, they'll be able to look back on the Noor plant as the laboratory that made Morocco a solar superpower, not just an expensive mirage in the desert. For The World, Chris Bentley, Marrakesh.
Here in the U.S., we're suddenly talking about anti-Semitism again. It's not a new thing, but there does seem to be an uptick. Just the other day, the folks at Merriam-Webster said the term anti-Semitism was one of the top lookups on their website. Why? Because Donald Trump was asked about it twice last week. Then he was asked about it again today. To talk about why, I've got The World's Matthew Bell in the studio with me. He covers religion for the show. So, Matthew, what exactly was the president asked today?
The president was asked about the recent wave of bomb threats to Jewish community centers across the country. What's so shocking about this is we're not even 2 months into the year 2017, and this is the fourth wave of threats by phone to places in many states, many community centers, daycare centers. There was also extensive damage yesterday to a cemetery outside of St. Louis. The president was on a tour today of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and he spoke with MSNBC's Craig Melvin, who asked Trump if he would denounce anti-Semitism once and for all. And here's what the president had to say.
I do all the time, and I think it's terrible. I think it's horrible. Whether it's anti-Semitism or racism or anything you want to think about having to do with the divide, anti-Semitism is likewise. It's just terrible. And you don't know where it's coming from, but I certainly hope they catch the people. I think you maybe have had it for longer than people think, and maybe it gets brought up a little bit more, but I will tell you that anti-Semitism is horrible, and it's going to stop, and it has to stop.
Sounds pretty straightforward, but that's not what President Trump has been saying in response to questions like that.
Right. As you mentioned, he was asked about it twice last week, and a lot of Jewish American leaders heard non-answers from President Trump. What they have been waiting for is this kind of sort of clear, direct condemnation of anti-Semitism. Last week, with those two questions that came at President Trump, at one point he got really annoyed. At another, he started talking about his Electoral College victory. This prompted responses like the one from David Harris, who's with the American Jewish Congress. He wrote an open letter to President Trump urging him to condemn anti-Semitism and to, quote, unleash the power of government to match deeds with words. I talked to another American Jewish leader recently who said, look, whether this is intended or not, what it has done in the real world is sort of embolden real haters of Jewish people. And it's really sort of fanned the flames of anti-Semitism.
Matthew, you mentioned the vandalism at the Jewish cemetery outside of St. Louis. We should say that our colleague Daniel Gross is here with us in the studio, too. And that story was a little more personal for you.
It was. The cemetery that was vandalized is just west of St. Louis, where my dad grew up. And I used to spend summers there with my grandparents. One of the nearby Jewish community centers that received a bomb threat last month is the same JCC where I learned how to swim. And my dad did, too. So I asked my dad about this, and he said that when he was growing up there, in 12 years, he never once perceived an instance of anti-Semitism.
So would you say in the St. Louis Jewish community, this bomb threat and this desecration of the Jewish cemetery are kind of unprecedented?
It definitely surprised my dad. But I also spoke to Karen Oresti of the Anti-Defamation League in Missouri, and she said she's certainly seen threats and acts of vandalism in the past, especially lately. She is glad that since the cemetery was vandalized over the weekend, this conversation has really gone national. Hillary Clinton tweeted about it, and it's been getting a lot of attention outside of the Jewish community.
I think people, regardless of religion, it hits a unique place emotionally when you think of a cemetery being that vulnerable. It's meant to be a place of peace, safety, and security in perpetuity.
My dad said one other thing, which is just that it's important to remember other religions that are under threat too, including American Muslims. This is something that a lot of people can identify with. And Oresti emphasized that, you know, there are some Jewish folks that are going to see this as a specific threat to Jews. And she sees that as totally valid. At the same time, there are other folks that are going to see this as a question of religious freedom. And her feeling is that both of these conversations can happen in parallel, and they're both important.
How does that strike you, Matthew Bell?
Yeah, you're alluding to this different groups talking to each other, and it's one thing I've seen from reporting on the religion desk is that there does seem to be this sort of nascent interfaith work that's going on recently because of our political divide, I think. For example, I talked to a Southern Baptist just last week who was writing about anti-Semitism. Very interesting. Just today, the Council on American-Islamic Relations said they would offer a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of whoever was responsible for these phone threats to the Jewish community center. So that's really interesting.
So interesting. The World's Matthew Bell and The World's Daniel Gross, thank you both.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. Bulgaria's national radio service is in kind of a bind. Normally, it broadcasts all kinds of Bulgarian music for its domestic audience, but it's run into a legal problem involving copyright protection, and that's putting a severe limit on what they can play on the airwaves. Boryana Jambazova is a Bulgarian journalist, and she gave me the details.
So basically, the Bulgarian National Radio is having a legal battle with Music Alter, which is an independent rights organization, due to their demand for higher prices. So as a solution, the radio started airing music which copyright expired 70 years after the death of the performer or the musicians. So for over a month or so, the Bulgarians have been listening to pre-war music, early century jazz, and classical music.
I mean, presumably this is a beloved broadcaster that was part of people's days. How did they like the new fare?
That's the interesting twist, because many people were worried that this will discourage listeners to tune in altogether. But instead, I have some friends who are quite happy with the music choice and the shift. And the radio itself has received many calls congratulating them. The head of the radio station actually reported that their ratings were up by 20% in January. I guess that was the surprising news for all sides involved.
We also called up Lily Golomanova at Bulgaria National Radio. She's a music director there. She says it's been challenging to come up with a playlist that's not under copyright, but they've actually rediscovered music they didn't even know they had.
Yes, we have an amazing archive at the Bulgarian National Radio, so we rediscover every day, like George Gershwin, playing George Gershwin. We also rediscovered many of the first recordings of the Symphony Orchestra of the Bulgarian National Radio, with some amazing performances of Beethoven's sonatas. Or we have some of the new bands, the emerging bands, like one of the best new Bulgarian bands, Jeremy, who gave us special declarations allowing us to use their music. So that makes the mix very interesting now, because we have on one hand the classical music and the jazz, And on the other side, the new emerging bands in Bulgaria, some of the best. So we rediscovered amazing, amazing Bulgarian pop and rock and all kinds of new music bands who keep coming and giving us the option to play their music for free.
That was Bulgarian National Radio Music Director Lily Gala Manova, and this is one of the new Bulgarian bands they're playing, Funk Miracle. And we end today with a new museum of old sound recordings. The Phono Museum opened in Paris in 2014, but it almost had to close last year. Emma Jacobs recently visited the collection of old and sometimes strange audio artifacts. Take a listen.
This is a recording made on a wax cylinder in 1898. It's rotating in a machine created by Thomas Edison, playing a poem about seeing ghosts at night.
Parce que c'est quelque chose quand même de extraordinaire.
It's an extraordinary thing to be able to hear someone without seeing them, like you're doing right now. You hear my voice.
This voice belongs to Jalal Aro, the man behind the Phono Museum, and a guy fascinated by recorded sound and the machines that evolved to play it. He winds the handle on one of the oldest objects in the gallery, built in 1880 in Switzerland.
Celle-là, elle est de 1880.
It's a giant cabinet with what looks like an enormous mechanical music box under glass.
C'est la première étape par rapport à tout ce qui est ce qu'on appelle musique notée.
It's the first step towards what we call recorded music.
Aro and his wife, Charlotte, began acquiring what became the core of the museum's collection 25 years ago. On the weekends, they pick through Paris's flea markets and junk shops.
C'est comme la radio. Vous allumez la radio, par hasard, vous tournez, on change de station, et après, tac, vous tombez.
It's like listening to the radio where you scan randomly between stations until you fall on something that interests you. Walking in the market, you stumble upon something you like.
Eventually, they began dealing in vintage audio equipment internationally, and their personal collection took over their small Parisian apartment.
Très grand, il y en avait partout, partout, partout. On essaye de mettre le... Voilà.
There was stuff everywhere, everywhere. What was fun was that our kids, they would play with the things when they were very young. We would explain to them how they worked.
They were also spending a lot of time explaining the same things to people who wandered into their shop near Montmartre. That's how they got the idea of opening a museum in the building next door. Today, the ground floor is stuffed with working phonographs and gramophones, ready to play for visitors. The earliest play cylinders, like this one, playing on another machine from the 1890s. These early recordings didn't feature new music. Because of the scratchiness of the sound, manufacturers stuck to classics of the time, so listeners could follow along. There are some crazy-looking machines, like one from the 20s shaped like a ski chalet. There's even one that played tiny records made of chocolate, now brittle and presumably very stale. Still, even with this collection, the museum hasn't gotten as many visitors as Aro had hoped. The city owns the building, and for a while, the museum owed more than $50,000 in back rent. They almost had to shut down.
On a fait le crowdfunding aussi, grâce à toute cette mobilisation.
We did crowdfunding, and all that mobilization created a different dynamic in talking with the city. It showed that there was interest.
They still have debts, but paradoxically, the threatened closure turned out to be very good for business. People who learned about the museum from the news coverage came to visit.
All of a sudden, people said, "Whoa, this sounds interesting. I'm going to go see it before it closes."
They're still talking with the city, but now, after this crisis, Aro can point to this support to show there are Parisians who really want the museum to succeed. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp. Thanks so much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.